Welcome to Ecker Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and today's podcast is with Nick Anderson. Nick is a former RAF F4 Phantom and Tornado F3 pilot, and he also did an exchange with the Royal Australian Air Force on the F-18 Hornet. This interview, he mainly focuses on the Hornet, but also talks about his time on the RAF Phantom and Tornado F3. So if you like what we do here, head over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help support us and to help us grow. Also, don't forget to visit the website at aircrewinterview.tv and please enjoy. Nick, how did you become interested in aviation?
Well, let me think about that. My father was an airline pilot. And he'd been a wartime pilot, so I kind of had it in the family. And I was, I suppose from the age of about 8 onwards, I was determined to become a pilot. What that trigger was, I really don't know, but having got it in my head that I was going to fly, it became a very strong ambition of mine. I kind of moved through school with the idea of getting just the right number of exams passed so that I could move on. As soon as I could, I became an air cadet. I probably joined about 6 months earlier than I could by pretending I was a little older than I was. But I spent many happy years messing about with aeroplanes and gliders in my early days as an air cadet. And, you know, it just moved on from there. I wanted to be a civil pilot initially. So my plan was to try and get a cadetship of some kind. But there weren't many jobs going when I was looking for them. That would have been the very early 70s. So I ended up joining a flying school as a kind of bottle washer and bog cleaner. And my job was to open the hangar every morning and taxi out the little Cessnas, park them on the flight line, fuel them up, make sure that they're all bright and shiny, and then go and clean up the clubhouse and basically look after the place for the day. And then when all the rich students had had their days flying, I would take them all back to bed, push them back in the hangar and jigsaw them into place. And that was kind of my first job in aviation. But I pretty soon realized that was going to be a very long and slow way to become an airline pilot. And I had a chat with the chief pilot of, would have been British United Airways at that time. That was the same company my father worked for, because he was an airline pilot. And he said, look, you're going to find it very hard at the current climate to get into civil aviation. Why don't you join the Royal Air Force? And I sort of hummed and hawed. Of course, I'd been an air cadet, and I'd got a flying scholarship through the Royal Air Force. I'd had to do the aptitude tests that you would do to become a pilot, and I'd passed those. And the RAF had shown an interest, so I wrote them a letter and they said, come along for some interviews. So, you know, it all starts off at Biggin Hill in those days for the Air Crew Interview and Aptitude Test Centre, where they had a hangar a bit like this and lots of brightly painted poles and barrels and things. And you were put in teams wearing boiler suits, and you had to try and build bridges and do all that kind of stuff. And then intermixed with that were interviews about current affairs and your interests and all the usual stuff. A great long medical. The medicals took hours and hours and hours. It was nearly a full day of medicals. And then, you know, I just sat and waited, and lo and behold, the letter came through offering me a permanent commission, which wasn't quite what I wanted. The ideal thing would have been to have got trained, or this was in my mind. Got trained, done a few years, and then gone off to civil aviation. But as it is, a permanent commission meant I was stuck in the Air Force for a long time. But once I got my teeth into it and realized just what a fantastic opportunity it was to fly some of these aircraft, I never looked back. I thought it was probably the most fortuitous decision I ever made.
What year did you join the RAF?
Well, that would have been 1974. It was November 74. I was just about 20 years old. Quite a youngster. We did a few months of officer training at RAF Henlow. So I wasn't one of those smart lads that went to Cranwell, where you did everything. It was officer training at Henlow. And then flying training kicked off once we'd graduated from there. Came out as an acting pilot officer with a stripe so thin, you know, you need a magnifying glass to see it. But in those days, we started off in the Chipmunk. And that was really kind of flying assessment. Did a few hours on those at RAF Church Fenton. But then really the big flying training was done at Linton-on-Ouse, just up the road, where we started flying on the Jet Propulsion Mark III. And then we did a basic course on there, a slightly more advanced course on the Mark V. That was pressurized, so that allowed us to go higher. And it was a little more powerful. The Jet Propulsion Mark III, if you sat on the end of the runway and rev the engine up, nothing seemed to happen except it got noisier. It was very underpowered, but the Mark V we thought was quite a swept up machine, at least certainly compared with anything else I'd flown. And that was, I guess, about 120 hours. And in those days, that was, you know, you came out with your wings. We had a wings graduation at the end and all trooped off to our various postings. Now, some guys were destined to go on to transports, some to helicopters. But most of us went off to the fast jet training unit at RAF Valley.
Nick chats about 43 Fighter Squadron.
At the end of the OCU, we were all posted to squadrons, and I was sent up to RAF Lucas, where 43 and 111 Squadron were. 43 Squadron, great history. 43 brackets, F brackets, because you're given that designation if you were a fighter squadron during the Battle of Britain. So it had a great history, 43 Squadron. And it had a lot of very senior aircrew on them, and they hadn't had a junior pilot for like years. One of my friends, Pete Radikoff, an earlier course, had been the first junior pilot they'd had, or fresh pilot they'd had, for about 2 years. So they kind of weren't really used to having guys who didn't know what they were doing there, which was quite interesting. So we kind of joined in, but there was a wealth of experience and sometimes a bit of a lack of patience, because all the pilots knew their job backwards, and we didn't know a damn thing, really. We kind of thought we did, but when it came to it, we did not know a damn thing. So it was hard work getting myself accepted, but that's often the way. And I was taught very early on that the thing to do is to just keep your mouth shut and keep your ears open, and just say yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir. And when you've done a couple of years, then you've probably got enough experience to voice a tentative opinion. Until that point, best not to try and display your level of knowledge or lack of. But 43 Squadron and 111 Squadron held a Northern QRA, and that was one of our main tasks up at Lucas. So that was kind of one of the first things we got trained to do. And that involved a lot of quite interesting flying. So we'd be doing visual identifications on other aircraft. We'd do them at night, aircraft with their lights out, called a phase three vis ident, where the navigator talked you in to be close enough to the target aircraft, which you could barely see with his lights out on without any moon in the sky. You really only saw him because of a lack of stars. And as you got close enough to him, your own nav lights would start to play on his fuselage and you'd start to pick out a few details. But literally, you had to be right on top of him to see him. And considering we were doing that using the radar only and the navigator talking sometimes very fast from the backseat, that was quite a job. But we then went on to our more operational roles. And I just love the front line. It was great to be considered doing a proper job, you know, after all the years of training. And it took me 4.5 years from joining the Air Force to becoming operational. I thought that was a great step, and it, you know, taken a while. And you think about it nowadays, the amount of training that pilots get, it's a drop in the ocean in comparison to what I was lucky enough to receive. So, you know, I feel very fortunate for that. I feel a bit sad for pilots that are pushed into flying jobs, whatever their flying jobs are, without adequate preparation. But I certainly felt I was well prepared and had lots of good stuff. And so that was my first tour, really, 3 years there, holding QRA, doing detachments, doing ACT against other aircraft, dissimilar ACT aircraft from other nations, flying around Germany and Norway, a lot of time over the North Sea, but that was kind of our job, to defend the north of the UK and defend the fleet. We were assigned land assigned squadron, so we did a lot of fleet defense, flying the old FG1s, which were the sort of ex-Navy Phantoms. When I first arrived at Lucas, the Navy conversion unit was still there. 892, I think, was their designation. They were just more or less winding up. And all those Navy aircraft were modded to RAF standard and painted in RAF colours. But still, they were pretty basic compared with the OCU aircraft, which were the full RAF standard. The FG1 had no inertial navigation system. It didn't have an HF radio, which, if you think about it, when you're working hundreds of miles north over the North Sea intercepting Russians, or Soviets as they were in those days, without an HF radio, had nowhere to talk to anybody. Unless the tanker was around, you could chat to him on VHF, which only, or UHF I should say, which only had a range of 100 miles or so, and he would relay on his HF radio. But so lack of HF radio was a bit of a problem for us. Radar was excellent, same radar on both types. We didn't have an internal gun. That was always a bit of a drawback for us, but we could strap one on underneath, taking the centerline fuselage station if we needed to. And it was a very good gun. It was excellent. You know, the old 100 rounds a second, 20 millimeter Gatling gun, which we always loved firing. It made a great noise. That was kind of my first tour. As came towards the end of that, I was hoping to get a tour in Germany. That was kind of where it all happened. I think that's where the best flying was. Unfortunately, the powers that be saw fit to post me back to RAF Valley, this time to be a flying instructor. So I was sort of extracted kicking and screaming from my Phantom cockpit and stuck in the new, or relatively new, trainer that was there now, the British Aerospace Hawk. We did 4 years on that tour. That was the sort of minimum. We all tried to get out early by volunteering for the Red Arrows, but that never worked, at least hardly for anybody. Simon Bedford, my flight commander, he was the only bloke I knew who got out to the Reds, but I think he had to serve most of his tour there. And that was a different job, sitting in the back of a Hawk. It was nice, instructor's aircraft, good view, great handling, very easy to fly. It was fun getting the students through and teaching them step by step how to do the various jobs that they were learning to do. I progressed to become a flight commander at Valley, and then I went up to Standard Squadron, where we trained and examined the instructors rather than teaching students, and ended up the flight commander on Standards, and finally got my A1 QFI qualification, which was a nice thing to finish up with, before being posted back to 43 Squadron, which was kind of fortunate. During my time at Valley, I'd kept my hand in by making regular visits back to the squadron as part of a war role that we ran. So you went back to your squadron, spent a few days flying the old Phantom again, and then the idea was you wouldn't have to clog up the OCU by doing another course when you finish your instructor's tour. You could just go straight back to the squadron because you had kept your hand in a bit. But even so, it was quite an interesting first few months flying it full time again. And of course, having a QFI qualification behind me, the Air Force were very keen for me to become the squadron deputy QFI, and then obviously eventually probably get a job at the OCU instructing, which was the last thing I wanted to do. I'd been a non-volunteer to become a flying instructor, and I just wanted to stay on the front line as much as possible. So I managed, I don't know how he managed it, but I managed to persuade my flight commander to try and get me a job on a weapons instructor's course, which was, for me, the pinnacle of all instructors' jobs. And he managed it somehow. I think there was a last-minute dropout of a student And next thing I knew, I was down at Coningsby as a student of the QI course, which was undoubtedly the hardest 6 months of my life. I cannot describe to you how much work we had to put into those 6 months to graduate. There were only a sort of a handful of students. I think there were six or seven of us. One of them was a flight controller, and so I think we had three crews. But it was so satisfying to finish that course, absolutely brilliant. I was lucky enough to win the top student prize, which was just unbelievable for me. Shared it with a lovely guy called Upton. Upton died. His real name was Simon, but everyone called it Upton. From there, I was angling to try and get a decent flying job off the QI course. And I had heard that there was an exchange job coming up that would have me out in Australia flying the, what was, to the Australians certainly, the very new F-18 Hornet. And lo and behold, I don't know how it happened, but my card came up, and next thing I knew, I was posted to Australia, which was the start of the three best years of my life, without a doubt.
Nick chats about the dream posting.
Dream posting was to Australia to fly the F-18. We packed up our boxes, you know, we put everything we owned, more or less. It wasn't that much, we hadn't been married very long. We had a fairly new baby. I'd recently set light to myself. A little domestic accident, igniting a barbecue, and which ended up with me in a helicopter being flown to a burns unit. And I was still recovering from that, all my own stupidity, I might add. So I still had bandages on, covering the skin grafts, but I wasn't going to give up that posting, that tour, for anything. So we jumped into the various RAF transport airplanes out to Hong Kong, and then Cathay Pacific, I think, down to Sydney, little puddle jumper up to my new home at Williamtown, Royal Australian Air Force Base, Williamtown. We used to call it Willy. The Aussies have a lovely habit of shortening your name into something they can squeeze it into. And if you've got a short name to start with, then lengthen it. But they'll never call you what your mother baptized you as, which is kind of endearing, but interesting. And I arrived, and the squadron I'd been posted to was 77 Squadron, which had a great wartime history. And had up to that point recently been flying Mirage 3s. And they were pretty long in the tooth and not the most brilliant of airplanes, and certainly the Australians were keen to replace them. And I understand there'd been many years, probably about 12 years of debate about what they were going to use to replace them. And they settled on the F-18, which for me was fantastic. I thought it was a brilliant choice. But, you know, there are other people who thought perhaps the F-16 might have been better, certainly cheaper. But whatever, I arrived in country and the F-18s had just started to sort of dribble in. The first few were flown across from the States. Some were even packaged up in the back of transport airplanes. But pretty soon they started assembling their own at their aircraft factory at Avalon in Melbourne. But when I got to 77 Squadron, they were still working full-blown with the Mirage. And I sat around for a while, wondering how this was all going to work out. And then we had a bit of a problem, because one thing the Australians had forgot to do was to check with the US Navy if it was okay that they let an RAF pilot fly one of their F-18s. Even though we had RAF pilots flying F-18s with the US Navy, that didn't matter. They wanted the Australians to seek permission. Now that put a bit of a hold on things for a while. So I had a trip in a Mirage, few trips in their trainer, the Mackie, and sort of kept myself generally busy, but I didn't really unpack because I didn't know if I was going to stay in country. Eventually permission was granted, and I was able to start flying on the operational conversion unit, number 2OCU, which obviously had mainly two-seaters. That's when I got my first trip in a Hornet.
Nick chats about the RAAF F-18 Hornet.
So we obviously did a lot of ground school to prepare ourselves for that, and they had a great simulator there. But it was very exciting to climb into that airplane for the first time. It was such a step up from the Phantom. I mean, just the cockpit design was superb. If you think about it, the Phantom was all iron instruments, you know, all mechanical gauges, very little electronics, hardly a computer in the whole thing. Whereas the F-18 was almost nothing but computers. Three fabulous electronic displays, full HOTAS, hands on throttle and stick. You could operate almost any mode of the aircraft and do almost any job of selection through the various switches on the throttles and the stick. So that was brilliant. And just flying it was a bit novel. The Phantom I had learned to just throw at the runway. I mean, that was the technique. You came in on an approach at the maximum angle of attack you were allowed to fly the airplane in the circuit, like 21 units. And so you didn't flare because that would have exceeded the angle of attack limit. So and you basically drove the airplane into the runway, and it was designed to handle that. So it worked fine. The F-18 could fly at an incredibly low speed, much lower than its landing speed. So you really had to learn to feel the airplane on the ground. I hadn't done that for years. So just took me a little while to get used to the fact that I didn't drive the airplane to the runway. And the first landing I did, my instructor squealed. So it didn't have a huge wheelbase on the undercarriage. It was quite narrow. So you could get up a bit of a waddle down the runway if you weren't careful. But basically, it was a very easy airplane to fly. You know, given a few trips, we all went solo very quickly. And then to be let loose on that machine was superb. It was quite a conventional airplane to fly at slow speed. But once you get it up to fighting speed, it was without the fly-by-wire computers stepping in and keeping an eye on things. It was effectively neutral, probably dynamically unstable. So part of the reason it could snap turns so well. But it, as far as we were concerned as pilots, it was completely carefree handling. And you could wrap it into a turn and pull as hard as you like, looking over your shoulder, confident in the knowledge that the aircraft would climb in G to its limit of 7.8. And then it would sit there at 7.8G no matter how hard you pulled. So you couldn't break the damn thing, it was superb. Whereas most of the airplanes I had flown had quite a strict angle of attack limit to prevent you stalling, and some had some pretty ugly stalling characteristics. The F-18, certainly the single seat version and definitely clean wing, had no effective angle of attack limits at all. You could snap the airplane into over 90 degrees angle of attack. And to give you an idea, that would really mean that the aircraft was traveling forwards, yet you were pointing more than 90 degrees vertically upwards or in any direction, which was great for a snapshot if you wanted to get a missile acquisition and shoot someone down quickly. It did rather kill the speed. You were left pretty slow at the end of one of those maneuvers, but could be damn useful. So the OCU went on to handling, and once the hiccup with permissions from the US Navy were cured, we went on to weaponeering, LOA combat, and that was quite an eye-opener as well, because in the Phantom I was used to a fight where your opponent was a couple of miles away because, you know, the airplane turned at around 16 degrees a second, something, perhaps a little less than that. The F-18 did about twice that. So we used to blithely call it a knife fight in a telephone box. Your opponent was almost so close you could reach out and touch him. And you know, the circles, the radius of the circles we flew in was only a few thousand feet across. It was just remarkable. And the airplane had so many tricks you could pull on it. As you grow confident with it and learn to use it to its best advantage, you could make the thing sing. It was absolutely fabulous. We did new stuff for me, so bombing. I hadn't done bombing since I did the tactical weapons course in the Hunter, but the Australians used the Hornet in its full multi-role capability, so they did everything that the aircraft was capable of. So we do a lot of combat, but then we went and threw bombs at the ground. Luckily, we were only ever required to throw one manual bomb, with using the reversion system, the old-fashioned cast iron bombing sight. And after that, we were allowed to turn the computers on and let the computers calculate when and how to deliver the bomb, which was damn accurate. My only ever manual bomb was unplottable at 12 o'clock, so which means I'd thrown it a long way, probably out of the range, knowing me. But after that, bombing was just like playing a computer game. You moved a little designator over the target, looking through your head-up display, and that was stabilized and just sat on your target. Leading away from it was a vertical line, which was your bomb fall line. So that was the line your bomb was going to travel, and that was obviously corrected for all the variables that were included: the aircraft speed, height, the drift, the wind, everything. And all you had to do was to put the flight path vector in the head-up display onto that bomb line, and you could then, if you wanted to, pitch up until the bomb release cue passed the flight path vector, in which case the bomb release. You could stay level, in which case the bomb release cue would come down the bomb fall line until the same intersection occurred. Or you could dive bomb the target, in which case it just happened a lot closer. But really it was just a matter of holding a commit switch and letting the bomb come off. There were other modes we used where we would more manually drop the bomb, where your flight path vector had a little line dangling underneath it with a cross on it, and that was where at any moment if you pressed the bomb release button your bomb would impact on the ground. So all you really had to do was to fly that little cross over the top of your target and then press the bomb release, and you were more or less guaranteed to hit it. Certainly the accuracy we got was phenomenal, and most of the misses I would suspect are caused because practice bombs have a sort of 8mm dispersion anyway, because they're not manufactured very accurately. So they didn't fly very true. So a lot of our misses were, and when I say misses, I'm saying anything outside 10 feet, were often because of the fact that we were using rather beat up old 8-pound practice bombs that have probably been around since, Pontius was a pilot. So that was good. Strafe was kind of something that I was getting back into. Always worried me a little bit. You had to get very close to the ground for strafe, usually in a dive, obviously. You'd have very short firing range, and if you didn't pull up with a nice firm 4 or 5 G, you got damn close to the target. You'd regularly watch guys kick up dirt with their jets as they pitched out of a strafing pass, as well as, of course, the ever-present danger of being hit with your own ricochets, despite the fact that you're shooting into a prepared range with banks behind to absorb the rounds. Obviously there's a lot of metal in that bank, and if you get one round hitting an old round, it can ricochet up in the air, and you can quite easily fly into it. So that was always a little bit of a concern, but it didn't worry us too much. So we did a lot of bombing and strafe and that kind of stuff. That was fun. A lot of combat, and then finally graduated, put our best bib and tucker on, had a lovely graduation ball, and then it was off to 77 Squadron. Now 77 Squadron were in the process of forming, so they basically shut the squadron down when they got rid of the Mirage, and they restarted the squadron with a whole new bunch of personnel, and I was there, one of the founder members of the squadron as it converted. And we kind of like have one airplane to start with, and the engineers all wanted to get their hands on it, the pilots always wanted to get their hands on it, everyone wanted to play with this one tapped airplane. So it was a bit of a bun flight for the first few months, but quite quickly more airframes arrived, and till eventually we had a full squadron complement. And then it was into working the squadron up. Now, I found it quite amusing, but I'd been posted to 77 Squadron as an air defense pilot, so I was considered myself a fighter pilot, not a bomber puke. So it was quite interesting when I discovered that 77 Squadron was to be the squadron that developed the Royal Australian Air Force's ground attack role and tactics. And I said, well, I'm kind of on the wrong squadron. That bunch over the road, 3 squadron, they're doing all the air-to-air tactics, and here I am on a squadron doing all the ground air-to-ground tactics. So, but you know, air-to-ground is just another job. You get the hang of it pretty quick. You draw an awful lot of maps, and you know, do an awful lot of attack profiles and learn all that kind of stuff. But so we effectively wrote the weapons manual for the Australian Air Force to follow, for all the other squadrons to follow, in the ground attack role.
Nick chats about DACT.
So the Australian Air Force only really had the Hornet. I mean, when we did training, we very hard to find a dissimilar aircraft of equal ability, or even close to equal ability. So we used to look abroad to try and find other aircraft to practice dissimilar combat against. The New Zealanders were always a great opponent. Now, they flew the A4, but you know, New Zealand was a bit of a stretch for them or us. So you know, we really had to make a bit of an effort to deploy down there and spend a couple of weeks with them if we were going to do some combat. And they used to come to Australia quite regularly. Of course, sadly, their government decided to do away completely with their fast jet force, so they no longer exist, which was a incredibly sad thing. I had enormous admiration for the Kiwi pilots. They used to fly those A4s legally down to 100 feet all day, every day. Every mission they went off, they were automatically authorized. And so they were incredibly capable at low flying. And those tiny little airplanes used to climb up out of the weeds. And you know, next thing you know, one will be right in your shorts before you had a chance to spot him. And they used to love going against us, because we used to sit up there at, say, 500 feet, trying to get the radar to peer down into the valleys. And if we didn't find them, and it was, you know, sometimes it's not easy, even with a radar as capable as the F-15, so the F-18 had, to pull out of a little Skyhawk that's hiding in a crease in the earth. If someone missed him and we came up close enough, he'd pop up out of the weeds and, you know, massacre you before you know what had happened. Very embarrassing. So they were good opponents. And then we had some larger exercises where we would either go up to Indonesia and fly against Indonesian Air Force, the Malaysians, the Americans out of Japan. So we regularly flew against American F-15s. EA-6s, they were always, the Prowlers were always a very capable opponent. I mean, they primarily would have flown at night, so their equipment, the jamming equipment, was formidable. I'm not kidding. It doesn't matter how sophisticated your radar is, you've got a determined opponent. He can usually drive the scanner off and completely befuddle the radar given enough time. And if we'd done it properly at night, they were almost unfindable. In daytime, you had the chance of actually spotting them, but nah, not at night. That was a great aeroplane. I'm trying to think what else. Oh yeah, up in Malaysia, we used to work with the F-5s. The Malaysians had some Hunters. Ah, that was going back a bit. And we used to practice exercises with them. That was great. And we were regularly up in Malaysia. Our squadron, well, the Royal Australian Air Force, had a commitment to help Malaysia by providing a permanent detachment of aircraft up at Royal Malaysian Air Force Base Butterworth, which used to be an RAF base during the war and then became an Australian Air Force base, and then the Malaysians obviously had it themselves. Lovely base and a great place to fly from, and we used to go 6 weeks at least every year up there. Great flying. Great low flying over the jungle. I used to really like that. Some super Rangers to fly at, and some great opponents. And the Malaysian pilots were, you know, very professional. Always enjoyed working with them. Nice bunch of guys as well. What was next?
Best and worst traits of the aircraft.
Well, the F-18, traits in the F-18. It's hard, really, because, you know, it's a bit like looking at a beauty queen, and she's got a gorgeous figure, She's voluptuous, she's pretty, she smiles, she's intelligent. And then you try and say, well, one of your toenails is misshapen. And that was like it with the F-18. It was a superb airplane. So the best traits. Well, it was two engine, which was always an advantage. I did have a couple of engine failures in the F-18. So, you know, if there had only been a single engine airplane, that might have been a ditching or an ejection required. So it maneuvered like a dingbat. The rate of turn on the F-18 was phenomenal. I would pitch it up against any of the best fighters in the world, Russian, American, anybody's, and say in the hands of an average pilot, an F-18 driver would win. So yeah, it was great. Perhaps it could have had a little more thrust, you know, every pilot says that. He always wants more powerful engines because when you maneuver the airplane really hard, the level of drag increases dramatically, and without a sufficient level of thrust, you've got to back off at times and regain some energy, and that's always a bit of a pain. So maneuvering was great. The weapon system were just world-beating. I've already touched on the modes you could go into. It did become a bit of an ergonomic disaster when you switch modes, because I'm going to use my hands here. On the throttle, there were 21 different functions you could select through the switches on the throttle. And of course, there's an equal number on the stick, or approximately. So, and they all varied. So when you were in the air-to-ground mode, the switches did one thing. When you switched to the air-to-air mode, they did something else. So trying to remember how to do all that was sometimes a bit of a nightmare. You know, you went away on 2 weeks leave. You really had to get into the simulator and remind yourself how the damn thing worked before you went and flew a mission. And before we changed our mission roles, we inevitably spent, you know, a week in the simulator practicing what we were going to be doing, so we had it squared away, how to use the airplane properly. And the software was often changing. So, you know, you come away from a week's leave and find that a new upgrade in software had been putting in and a new few functions had arrived, and you go, how does this work? But the whole thing was designed around a data input box in front of you where you could put in lats and longs for targets, you could change radio frequencies, you could change your IFF squawks, you could do almost anything input. A pair of TV screens either side, you know, one might have flight information, the other one might have all the weapons on the aircraft, and those TV screens were switchable and you could change modes on them. Obviously you'd have the radar up on one usually. I had a moving map display between your knees, and that was very flexible with all sorts of other inputs you could put in, not just from your inertial, but you could input from the radar, you could input from navigation beacons, all that kind of stuff. And of course the head-up display, so it had very few iron instruments, everything was electronic, the head-up display was wide, inverted commas holographic display, get a great feeling of distance properly focused so that it was in focused infinity. You didn't have to pull your eyes in to focus on the head-up display. You could look out at infinity and everything was clear and sharp. And you could change the amount of information on that display as well. So you could pull everything you wanted on it, or you could declutter it if you got, say, into a combat scenario and you wanted to be able to see through it more clearly. So that was brilliant. The aircraft had a reasonable number of weapon stations, so you had a winder on each wingtip, and you could semi-fair a couple of Sparrows air-to-air missiles onto the fuselage after the air intakes. But that probably was a bit of a disadvantage in that if you took on an F-15, he had twice the missile load you did, which when you're throwing missiles at long range, and some of them are obviously not going to reach their target because of the tactics you're employing, you can run out of missiles pretty damn quick. So that, you know, would be a disadvantage against a larger aircraft. And of course it was relatively light and slim, so the radar scanner was perhaps not as big as some. Certainly the F-15, the Eagle radar, was very, very capable and had a little bit of a slightly better range and certainly better target definition. They could sort out one of our formations and pluck individual aircraft out at a long range that we could, which is also very useful when you're employing beyond visual range missile tactics. So it really depended what opponents you were going to be flying against as to whether these were advantages or disadvantages. So if, you know, some aircraft had better radars but couldn't turn as well, so the F-18 would win in some areas and perhaps lose in another. But there certainly weren't many areas where I felt that it lost. It really was a remarkable aeroplane. And of course, now they've improved it even more, so God knows what it's capable of now.
Nick chats about his time in Australia.
3 years with the Australians, remembering that it took me a little while to get going. I only managed to get about 600, just over 600 hours on the Hornet, which was a crying shame. I always like to fly more, but that was kind of the going standard. Flying much more than about 250 hours a year was quite unusual. You have to bear in mind that for a one-hour mission, you'd probably be planning for an hour, you'd be briefing and preparing for at least an hour, take half an hour to get the airplane wound up, you fly for an hour, and you come back and the debrief would be, you know, sometimes 2 hours for every hour in the air, or often at least 2 hours for every hour in there. So one mission would take up a half day. If you did two missions in a day, that was a long working day, and you'd get home pretty exhausted. So to build up that number of hours, you know, takes some effort. It's impossible to compare with the hours that a civil airline pilot, for example, has, because they're chalk and cheese. In a fighter, when you're flying every second of every minute of every hour, you're doing something. You never really sit back and just cruise. Never happens. So yeah, those 600 hours were jam-packed with activity. And I have to say, I look back on that tour as the greatest flying I ever did, with some of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet, in one of the most beautiful countries in the world. And it was with a considerable number of tears that I was pulled away to come back to Earth, as it were, with the Royal Air Force at the end of my tour, and be posted onto the Tornado.
Nick chats about the Tornado F3 and 111 Squadron.
So, moving back from the Australian Air Force, I rejoined the world of the Royal Air Force and was posted on the Tornado F3. Now, that involved a conversion at Coningsby, and I quite quickly learned to be a little disappointed in the F3. You have to imagine that I've come from one of the world's most swept up aeroplane, even though, you know, the F-18 had started its life before I even joined the Air Force, as the YF-17 that first flew in about summer 1974, somewhere around there, to now be flying brand new fighters that weren't half as capable. I felt very disappointed. But I got through a tour that was difficult in many ways. I was posted back to Lucas, but this time on the girls' school, as we used to call them, 111 Squadron, who were the other unit that I hadn't yet to serve on up there. But we started off with brand new, straight off the factory floor, latest modification F3s, which we felt were pretty good compared with the OCU aircraft. But then Gulf War I broke out. We weren't operational. So all our aircraft were shipped off to operational squadrons who were going to deploy, because our aircraft were the most capable and the newest. And the Air Force then went around all the other F3 squadrons and said, do you have a couple of airplanes you can loan 111? And if you were asked that question, what kind of airplanes would you hand over? Well, the answer is obvious. The worst airplanes in your fleet, the hangar queens, the Christmas trees, as we used to call them, we got them all. So we ended up with a whole mishmash of various aircraft, different mod states, coming apart, airplanes that had permanent problems that we could never fix. The operational squadrons didn't want to take any new OCU pilots, so because they were obviously considering going to war. So all the new OCU pilots were posted at 111, and we became just an extension of the OCU. So we just did training for, you know, almost my entire time there. So it was not a squadron with great morale. I didn't have a brilliant time there. Quite honestly, flying the airplane was no great joy. It helped me make up my mind that it was probably time in my career to move on and perhaps try my hand at civil aviation. So having made the decision to come out of the Air Force and go into civil flying, I then discovered that there were no jobs. I mean, for a start, the change over to a civil license wasn't easy. 14 exams to sit to get an ATPL, plus you had to rent airplanes and do a civil instrument rating. It was not cheap, cost in the region of £15,000-£20,000. And then there were no jobs. So for a year, I was more or less unemployed. Did a little bit of flying for British Aerospace, doing trials flying on the Tornado for them, and delivered a few airplanes. That was great fun, but short-lived and real hand-to-mouth stuff. And then at last, the Gulf War came towards an end, and the floodgates opened, and the airline started recruiting. And I joined a long-haul airline in the UK, and I've been flying long-haul Airbuses since. And I have to say, swapping from a smelly green flying suit into a nice crisp uniform with pretty ladies serving coffee and nice meals was an absolute pleasure. I really did enjoy that step over. I've been doing that job now for 22 years, and so although it's starting to pale a little bit at my age, approaching 62, it's actually a fine way to go flying, and I love the destinations, and I love the fact that I'm getting around the world and seeing a lot that I would never have had the opportunity otherwise.
Here we hear a more personal side to Nick.
Do you have any hobbies?
Yeah, I do actually. In fact, my life is full of hobbies. Perhaps a little unexpectedly for an ex-fighter pilot, I love lawn bowling. I've been doing that for many years, and play with a great club in Chichester, the Chichester Lawn Bowling Club. And I find it a great way to relax. It's very competitive, even though it's not great exercise. You can't do anything but concentrate, and it's nice after a flight where you've really worked hard to relax with the old fellas and put a few bowls out on the green and have a few beers. It's very pleasant. I run a little photographic business. I've always been very keen in photography, ever since I was a youngster. And it's hard to find a niche where you can make a little bit of money at that. Since I'm a dog owner, I've got three Hungarian Vizslas, I found a little niche there photographing gun dogs. An awful lot of people out there who train their gun dogs. They're very keen to have decent photographs of them, and it gives me a little avenue to make a few pounds profit. So I've got a thing there. And I podcast, funny old thing. I'm quite recently joined the Airline Pilot Guy crew as their sort of European Airbus bloke, and the old curmudgeon, as they call me. So I do a weekly podcast with Jeff and the Airline Pilot Guy crew. In fact, tonight we're going on with our episode 220, which will be, we do a live Google Hangout, and then you can find it on YouTube afterwards. And of course, it comes out in a beautifully edited podcast later on. So that's another thing I love to do, and it keeps me busy.
Do you ever head to air shows?
No, I'm not a great air show bloke. I suppose I was a bit spoilt when I was in the Air Force, because we had a lot of opportunities to go to air shows. We're often flying static aircraft in there for displays. You get the best seat in the house. You'd be sitting on your Tornado there at Biggin Hill or Farnborough and watching the aircraft. Now to have to pay to go in and queue and find parking and stand amongst thousands of other people, not being able to get decent shots for your camera, I don't really enjoy so much. However, I'm going to be at Farnborough this year, I hope, with Jeff and the Airline Pilot Guy crew, because we're doing, I think we're doing a live podcast from there, and certainly having a great meetup with many of our followers, the APG Army. So that'll be fun.
Do you have a favourite aircraft?
Yeah, I have to keep going back to the Phantom. I mean, it's your first operational airplane probably is the one that digs its way into your heart the most. And I think probably Foxtrot on 43 Squadron. The airframes were all lettered so we could tell them apart. And Foxtrot was given to me, in inverted commas. So I had my name on the fuselage. So Flying Officer Anderson, Flight Lieutenant Tony Bowen, and SAC Lenny, who was our line mechanic, and we all had our names on that aircraft. So that one has a special place in my heart. The Phantom, certainly, I think, is something I cut my teeth on as a pilot, and gave me confidence to know if I could fly the Phantom, I could probably fly anything they threw at me. And funny enough, Foxtrot is still alive and well. It's not flying, but it is now called Black Mike, because that airframe went to 111 Squadron, where they painted it black and it became their display aircraft. And there is quite a big move afoot to try and save Black Mike and turn it into a museum piece somewhere. So if you're interested, anyone can find that on the internet and find out more information. But that at one point used to have my name on the fuselage. Very nice.
Do you have a favorite tipple?
Well, I'm a bit of a whiskey man, and I like craft beers. And Jeff and Dr. Steph on the APG crew, they're great craft beer and IPA lovers. So I've had to learn a little bit about craft beer so I can at least have an intelligent conversation with them. Because Dr. Steph, for a lady doctor, she knows how to put away her beers, and she knows an awful lot about craft beers. So yeah. But I think when it comes down to it, at the end of an evening, it's, you know, a really nice malt whiskey, or perhaps a glass of Remy Martin.
There was also an incident in New Zealand. Could you tell us about this?
Ah, yeah, that really nearly went very wrong for me. I was probably second or perhaps even my last detachment out there. And I was leading an 8-ship of aircraft. Probably even more, it might have been a 12 ship actually. So it was a combined mission with the New Zealand A4s and a bunch of Hornets. And we went off and did sort of a low level attack mission. The A4s were bouncing us, we were trying to defend ourselves. And then we all sort of got together in a kind of mass formation. And the idea was we were going to put on a bit of a show for the troops and do a sort of a kind of a fly past stroke dogfight over the airfield. And the idea was we'd join up in a big daisy chain, so it would be led by an F-18 and then A4 F-18 all the way down a big log daisy chain, and we kind of weave our way around the airfield a few times, all pretending we're all gunning each other in some huge massive attack. And the station commander, Ahakia, who briefed it, said the Yeti had one rule, and that was no one was to fly over the flight line. So I briefed everyone. I said, all right, at the end of the join up, and we've done a few wing overs and got up and down the airfield a few times, we'll do a final fly past. Now I will fly up against the flight line, and I want everyone to be to the right of me, so no one goes over the flight line, okay? And unfortunately, I misjudged my turn on. I'm going to put little air commas there. And I snotted the flight line at about 500 knots at about 30 feet. The station commander, Ahakia, quite rightly, went through the roof. He was livid. He sat down with the boss and they tried to work out how they were going to court-martial me. And I wouldn't have blamed them, quite honestly, because the rules have been quite specific. But I think they fell foul of the fact that I was an RAF officer working with an Australian Air Force unit, and the incident happened in New Zealand. And they were scratching their heads probably, trying to work out whose rules they were going to charge me under. And I guess my boss probably managed to talk him down, because all that happened was next morning, when we all got together for our morning prayers, we used to call it, it was an 8 o'clock in the morning briefing where all the pilots and station operational personnel gathered in a big briefing room to talk about the day's events. The first thing the station commander Ahaki did was to ask me and my Australian cohort, who had also fallen foul of the same rule, to stand up, and then gave us a public dressing down, which probably lasted 5 minutes and was one of the better bollockings I've had in my Air Force career. So that was then considered case closed.
Do you ever get sick of talking about flying?
Well, no, actually, I get a lot of practice now, because with our weekly APG podcast, which lasts a good 3 hours, we're kind of talking flying the whole time. And when at work, you're inevitably talking flying. And I do now meet an awful lot more people who have a great interest in flying. And I find it very humbling, because something that I have sort of taken for granted, I suddenly realize many, many people in the world have a real passion for flying. And I really enjoy their company, I enjoy talking about flying. So no, I don't, is the answer. And I hopefully will be able to carry on for, you know, many years if people will put up with me.
And finally, where can we find you?
Well, I've got a Facebook presence, my personal Facebook presence, but you'll certainly find the Airline Pilot Guy on Facebook. Just search for Airline Pilot Guy, it's easy to find. We've got an Airline Pilot Guy Twitter feed, so that's at APG Crew. We're on Swarm, if anyone's interested. The Airline Pilot Guy has a website. I have my photography website, which is www.nickandersonphoto.co.uk. If anyone's interested in looking at handsome dog pictures, but only if you're interested, please.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and don't forget to visit us at patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help support us, and also visit our website at aircrewinterview.tv. Thank you.